This podcast is first and foremostly about leasehold abuse. But first of all, let's take a brief look at what the leasehold and freehold frameworks are. I assume, as you're already here, that you have a fair understanding of what both of these entities are, because you're unlikely to be listening to this podcast if you didn't have a fair idea already. But just to ensure I've covered this ground, and so that it's entirely clear in your minds, let's step into the world of leasehold. When buying any leasehold property, you are simply buying the right to live on the land for a specific period of time. However, you're not buying the land itself. That's the freehold. Buying a leasehold property means that when the lease ends, you either need to apply to renew the lease, or it reverts back to the ownership of the freeholder. Looking at it this way, for your period in office as a leaseholder, your lease is your contract with the freeholder or freeholders. There's no doubt that it is quite a ridiculous practice, and one which stems from a historical feudal system of property ownership in the UK, where lords would own the land but allow people to lease the right to live on them. And obviously we do still see this today, with the freehold of properties being owned by one or several people. So with that in mind, when buying any leasehold property, without doubt, you must check the rates, ground rent, or any other payment you may make to the freeholder for the upkeep of the building or grounds. But make no mistake, this can and will change at any time, and by no modest amount. And that's leasehold and freehold in a nutshell. So what is leasehold abuse? Well, that's a very big question, for which multiple examples can be provided, as it generally comes packaged in different forms. But really, what we should be asking is, what is abuse in general? In my world, abuse is essentially one party taking full advantage over another party through either situation, position, or circumstance to really meet their own needs, wants, and desires. The literal dictionary definition of the term abuse is to use something to bad effect or for bad purpose. Similar verbs are to misuse, misapply, misemploy, mishandle, exploit, or pervert. The term abuse also describes treating someone or something with cruelty or violence, especially regularly or repeatedly. Similar verbs include to mistreat, maltreat, ill-treat, treat badly, ill-use or misuse. I know that these are all terms that I've used historically when dealing with a specific case of leasehold abuse myself. But I've also applied terms such as misappropriate, misdirect, and misinform as well. What I will say, when you're dealing with what is essentially abuse of power, is that if you think the post office scandal was an abomination that defies belief insofar as gaslighting, lies, deceit, misdirection, misappropriation of funds, and downright underhandedness and exploitation, this scenario doesn't even touch the surface where leasehold and leasehold abuse is concerned. I'm going to start this episode by quoting a very famous 18th century French economist, Frédéric Bastiat. And he said that when plunder becomes a way of life for a group of men in a society, over time, they create for themselves a legal system that authorises it and a moral code that glorifies it. I'll repeat that statement again if you didn't catch it the first time. When plunder becomes a way of life for a group of men in a society, over time, they create for themselves a legal system that authorises it and a moral code that glorifies it. And I'd ask you to really think about what that statement means and what he's telling us, because I'll be referring to it repeatedly throughout this series of podcasts. I really love this statement because what Frederick appears to be telling us is really what we already know. And that is that essentially those that make the law design it in such a way so that it becomes inapplicable to themselves, i.e. so that they can break it. It calls to mind the saying that I've heard many a time, those that make the law break the law. And this guy was 18th century, so he'd have been examining the state of affairs over the past 100 years before him. And what is key about what he says is that this happens over time. Over time, they create for themselves a legal system that authorises it and a moral code that glorifies it, he claims. And that correlates with the fact that abuse almost always invariably happens over time, not overnight. Well, in my opinion, that's because the rule makers assess the lay of the land, if you'll pardon the pun, in order to assess and establish the limitations of those rules unto themselves, which obviously shapes the associated laws, as of course law is predicated on precedence. So if no one challenges these laws successfully, they become more and more impossible to challenge over time. And of course the offenders become more and more untouchable. I mean, that really is something, isn't it? And what it tells us overall is that essentially the crimes don't change. The only thing that changes is the way they're carried out. So returning to the subject of abuse in general, let's think about how that manifests. We know of abuse of power, sexual abuse, racial abuse, child abuse, physical and verbal abuse, and of course, financial abuse. And one of the key questions I have, and certainly one that I don't believe the legal justice system does a good job of answering, hence bringing Frederick Bastiat's quote into play, is why financial abuse is treated any differently to any other kind of abuse by the legal justice system in the UK. In my view, this is a particularly poignant question, given that all crime can be mapped directly back to the top three human motivators, those of power, money, sex, and in that particular order. These same three key motivations are the drivers or byproduct of each and every war, which is first and foremostly about land theft supplying the power and the money aspect, and of course sex or sexual abuse being a byproduct of all war, no matter how big or small. I mean, war is generally shrouded in excuses of religion or the adoption of other differences of colour, race, divine right, ownership, or whatever the differential is that you want to employ. But fundamentally, it's about land theft, utilising abuse of power to secure it. And that's really where financial abuse in leasehold comes in. And let's face it, land theft is the oldest crime in the book and dates back to biblical times. People have fought to take each other's land for centuries. And when you're dealing with matters of leasehold, leasehold abuse is no different. It's nothing short of direct or indirect land theft. So what is direct and indirect land theft? Well, I'll give you some examples of what I've come across and my experiences a bit later on. But essentially, direct land theft is when someone literally takes land from another and assumes it for themselves. Now, the law states that you're not entitled to do that because land cannot be physically stolen. However, you can be guilty of land theft in certain circumstances. One, if the defendant is acting as a trustee and they then sell the land, they may be convicted of theft. Two, if the defendant does not possess the land and removes items from it forming part of that land, i.e. topsoil or crops, they may be convicted of theft. Or three, if the defendant has a proprietary interest as a tenant and removes fixtures from the land, they too may be convicted of theft. So given those three scenarios, it is difficult to comprehend how land can be stolen outside of those parameters. But you see, I beg to differ with the statement that land cannot be stolen, because in the real world, land theft is happening every day. You see, the law is predicated by people simply doing right by it and sticking to or abiding by the law. But what if they don't? Who's going to do anything about it? How does a victim of land theft even begin to prove what's going on? And who deals with it? Is it the police, the first tier property tribunal, a county court, or is it a criminal court? The big question is, how on earth do you stop it from happening, and who exactly does anything about it in that situation anyway? So that's direct land theft, but what about indirect land theft? What's that? Well, it isn't really a recognised thing, and certainly one that isn't explicitly recognised in law. But in my experience, indirect land theft is when a leaseholder is driven from their home by greedy, unscrupulous, even psychopathic freeholders or their representative management companies. And it's achieved generally by imposing inflated prices or fake costs or falsified costs and charges. It's imposed by a failure to even deliver a service or supplier fixing or rigging, forcing leaseholders to use suppliers as dictated by the freeholder or their management company. In many instances, you'll find that these suppliers have inextricable links with both or either party, either through ownership or kickback agreements. Indirect land theft can also be achieved by the delivery of poor or substandard services when services are delivered. In my experience, such poor services remain extremely high cost. It's also achieved through the disappearance of funds altogether that simply can't be accounted for, forcing the leaseholder to pay again for charges they believed they had paid for several years earlier. I've often referred to certain such funds as the Scotch Misbuilding Fund as an example, when referencing long-term funds collected over time for major works. So these are the big ticket items, such as recarpeting or interior redecoration, or funds collected for structural works, for example, repointing or roof works. I mean, it's fair to say that many people would fail to recall what they had for dinner the night before, let alone what they paid into a fund 1, 2, or even 3 years earlier. And sometimes these funds are collected over many years, especially those purportedly set aside for major works. Although you could argue that this is direct theft, however, the ability to prove such events is limited to the leaseholder, thanks again to legal restrictions surrounding documentation leaseholders are entitled to access, for example, bank statements. But essentially, indirect land theft is about several things. Number one, it's about eliciting funds from leaseholders that are unwarranted, unlawful, and more often than not, unsubstantiated and often unaccounted for, ultimately generating immoral profit. Number two, making the experience for the leaseholder and their right to peaceful enjoyment so unbearable they are forced to move. Ultimately, and among other contributing factors, this gives rise to a reduction in the value of the property such that the freeholders can secure the leaseholds at rock bottom prices for themselves, further aligning with their redevelopment motives and plans. Indirect land theft tends to be a long, drawn out and painful process, but it can also be a quick succession of insurmountable challenges that the leaseholder simply feels they are unable to do anything about or challenge, therefore simply up and leave at a loss to themselves. As I said earlier, I'll give you a few examples of direct and indirect land theft in my next episode. But firstly, I'd like to talk to you a bit about my historic court battles with freeholders, where they have claimed that building funds, for example, are held in trust for certain funds collected. In my experience of select management companies, I maintain that little or no trust is warranted, neither with the freeholders nor their respective management companies. For example, one particular management company has collected a total of £339,000 from residents since 2008. Of that, £163,000 is purportedly for building and structural related matters. Of that £163,000, the freeholder is liable to contribute a further 39%, equating to approximately £64,000. That's an overall collective operating fund of £403,000 collected to run a small block of 12 one-bedroom flats and grounds. During that time, insofar as any big ticket items, we have had a small roof repaired and one main wall repointed in 2010 and 2016 respectively. More specifically, the repointing since then has been proven to have been excessively charged for and of substandard quality by several chartered surveyors, one of whom who's been in the business for some 42 years. In 2018, we had our first and only refurbishment since 2002 at an outside cost of roughly £12,000, and that includes the management company's 10% non-standard works charges. The quality of the works carried out on the interior redecoration was also exceptionally poor in my opinion. Indeed, the same supplier appears to be used again and again for similar works, not only in this particular block, but elsewhere as well. Indeed, the particular freeholder associated with this block has recently been served with an injunction for extortion in another case by the Crown Court. It will be of no surprise then that I have found myself in a leasehold situation that is overtly financially abusive, exploiting a system that is wide open for processes and practices to follow. I want to close this episode by highlighting that in 2002, governmental rules surrounding right to manage, also known as RTM, became more stringent, forcing many residents' associations and smaller blocks of flats into managed service scenarios. This is especially true where freeholders appear to have complete 360-degree control and influence, and are not only the freeholders, but also the management company chairman, director, and leaseholders. What government appears to have done with leasehold is to give freeholders the powers of bankers in an industry sector that is entirely void of all financial regulation. I mean, imagine that. A world of banking that is void of all financial regulation. It doesn't bear thinking about, does it?